Welcome. You are listening to Copland. Copland is about the life and times of our protectors and defenders, police, fire, EMS, medical trauma units, and the military. The underappreciated doing the unthinkable for the often ungrateful. I am Jay Dobbins, and I'll be your host. In each season, we will hear three episodes featuring extraordinary heroes, amazing personal experiences that will inspire and uplift you. Sometimes they might shock you. The highs and lows, the successes and the failures, told in their own words and all experienced during their personal journey of sacrifice to make the world a safer place. This is Copland.
They're trained mercenaries.
This is a gang like you've never seen before.
Their code of silence unparalleled. Their ruthlessness unquestioned.
They are killer machines. Killer machines with no soul.
Los Zetas are one of America's deadliest gangs. And those who stand in their way pay a gruesome price.
They burn these individuals in a 55-gallon drum using diesel because diesel burns slower.
They've had people's heads cut off, thrown into a disco.
The gang already rules Mexico. And now their sights are set on controlling this side of the border.
The Zetas have more capability than Al-Qaeda does today to operate inside the United States.
In February of 2011, Victor Avila and his partner, Jaime Zapata, Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, encountered an officer's worst nightmare. Traveling alone on a remote highway in Mexico, they were ambushed by members of the Los Zetas drug cartel. Victor was critically wounded. The gun battle took the life of Agent Zapata. Much of the backstory to this event involves government corruption, cover-up, and the illegal supply of weapons to drug dealers. That topic, although important, will not be the focus of this episode. For today, rather than getting hung up on the bad acts and dirty deeds of some, Copland will honor Victor and Jaime's story, their careers, and their lives. The heroism and bravery of two young federal agents in a foreign country doing battle against human smuggling and the narcotics trafficking poisoning America.
Yeah, Jay, when I was a teenager, I joined the police explorers down in El Paso. I'm born and raised in El Paso, Texas. And I became a police explorer. And that was, I think the, back then the explorers were attached to the Boy Scouts. And I really learned to kind of be surrounded by law enforcement. And that was very, very new to me. I learned that police are normal people just like everybody else. And I got to do a lot of community service. And of course, the ride-alongs were a lot of fun. And that's what kind of spiked my interest into law enforcement. I started my career as a state parole officer for the state of Texas. Then I moved up to a United States probation officer. After doing that for about 3 years, in the middle of that, that's when I applied to become a special agent with U.S. Customs Service. That's when the U.S. Customs Service and the old INS merged, that when ICE was created.
Victor established himself as an expert investigator in narcotic smuggling, human trafficking, and international financial crime.
I was very fortunate to be placed back on the border in El Paso as my first assignment. And of course, it was narcotics, as mostly everybody else does. You know, there's a heavy presence of law enforcement in El Paso, especially federal law enforcement with Border Patrol and marshals and you name it. And narcotics was the name of the game back then. And that was my initial assignment as a narcotics conspiracy investigation group, which I loved. I loved doing that. And had a great time doing those types of investigation right around the border. I knew the border very well. I know the city like the back of my hand. Plus, I also knew the Mexican side, Juarez. I grew up going over to the border. And so it was very advantageous to me to know when people came over and told me stories about how they got recruited to bring these drugs over or whatever the case may be. I kind of knew what they were talking about. I knew the areas. I had physically sometimes even been in that area. So that was very advantageous to my investigations. And then one day, as you know, it happens in the federal government, one Friday afternoon, I got a memo saying that I was being transferred to the human smuggling, human trafficking group. And I was very upset about it initially, because I was having such a great time in narcotics investigations. But it really changed my career, because as a merger with ICE, that was something new that we were going to have to learn, is the other side. And I ended up being the point of contact for the human trafficking task force. And eventually throughout my career became the subject matter expert in human trafficking investigations. But ironically, the case that made my career, you know, a lot of agents have their case that they do. And mine was a big human smuggling case that involved a corrupt Border Patrol agent. And so this corrupt Border Patrol agent was allowing illegal aliens to go through the checkpoint at $500 a head. He was working with an organization out of Mexico. And I was able to, it was a great investigation, Title III, wiretaps, cameras, you know, all the gadgets that you always wanted to use in investigation. I was able to really get that kind of experience for that case. And that kind of made my name in the office. That eventually got me to get transferred to a financial investigations group and deal with the money laundering aspects of investigations.
Victor began his in-country service in Juarez, Mexico, later relocating with his family to Mexico City.
And then kind of in the mix of all that, this is now 2008, I was kind of introduced to the two ICE representatives, that's what they referred to them, that were assigned to the U.S. consulate in Ciudad Juarez on the other side of the border. And I was in contact with them a lot, and a position came up for a temporary assignment there. And I put in for it. I volunteered for it. This is 2008, when it was the height of the violence in Mexico, especially in Ciudad Juarez. They were killing about 350 people a month just in that city. And so it was kind of a surreal kind of feeling for me, because, you know, I grew up knowing that area very well. And but the violence just really diminished. And even to this day, that city hasn't recovered completely. But I got the assignment, and that's what introduced me to what led to my official Mexico assignment and become a diplomat, an accredited diplomat, and actually a full assignment that I moved my family to Mexico City at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City in 2009.
Victor came to be identified with the shooting incident he survived, but often lost in the telling of his story is the true expertise he had developed as an investigator.
And I really appreciate that, Jay, because I did lose a lot of identity after the shooting. You know, people kind of, even to this day, that people refer to me as a guy that survived the shooting. Well, I did, and I did have this experience, but let me tell you, I was a pretty decent investigator. I was a proud investigator and proud of my hard work. And you're absolutely right. I like that you give credit there, because there's no offense taken. I was a border rat. And I did the groundwork, and I'm proud of that, because that built my experience to what I would become. And that was the conscientious effort as to why I wanted to take the assignment in Mexico City.
Victor's work as a diplomat turned out to be something different than what he had anticipated.
Here I am, a U.S. diplomat. I'm going to go to dinners and parties, and I'm going to wear a suit. And I did do that. But let me tell you, that was the secondary function of our mission. In Mexico, as you know right now, how things are, I never thought back then they were going to get worse, but they are. But we were very, very much hand in hand with the government of Mexico in all aspects of law enforcement, training, criminal investigations, victim witness identification, interrogations. Oh, my God. Court processing. You know, Mexico has a written closed system versus our open oral system in the United States. So we would train them on how we conduct investigations and how we, our method in the United States, plus at the same time sharing intelligence, trying to get some of these bad guys off the street, which I'm proud to have been successful in some of those. But my main focus were, other than some money laundering cases, arms trafficking cases, drugs and all that, as you know, that just kind of comes with the territory. My focus was human trafficking. And I did a lot of human trafficking conferences, trainings, also undercover trainings in Mexico City, money laundering trainings. But human trafficking was my go-to thing. I led the Global Trafficking in Persons Initiative in Mexico. I was able with that to really conduct transnational investigations simultaneously in Mexico and the U.S., take down several human trafficking organizations that were, you know, smuggling and trafficking girls and women from Mexico to Atlanta, New York, Miami, Houston. And I was able to be successful in working in conjunction with our ICE offices in the U.S. to bring some of these organizations down and dismantle them.
The violence of the Los Zetas drug cartel came as no surprise to Victor. He was well-versed in who they were and how they operated.
Well, the Zeta cartel is unique in a sense that of how they began. The Zetas cartel were the original founders of that were elite military forces from Guatemala and Mexico. They initially started off as kind of like the enforcers and security for the Gulf cartel. Then they, you know, branched out and became the Zetas and their own cartel, and really are known for their ruthlessness and level of violence to this day. They got pretty hit hard when obviously the shooting happened with us in 2011, and some of the big heads were taken down and arrested, some were killed, and it really kind of disbanded them. And so right now there's a faction of them called Cartel del Noreste, the CDN, which is gaining a lot of traction down in northern Mexico, down in the Tamaulipas, Laredo, Texas area there on the other side of the border. And they're still there, and they're a force to be reckoned with. They are still fighting for that territory. They're still involved in the extortion, the kidnappings, the murder, the drug trafficking, and now the human trafficking, child trafficking that we've seen with all these caravans coming through Mexico.
Although Victor only knew Jaime Zapata for a short period of time, their personal bond was instantly strong.
I knew Jaime for a very, very small amount of time. I was, when I got the assignment on February 14th, on Valentine's Day of 2011, in the afternoon, that's the first time I met Jaime. As a matter of fact, I had just arrived in country. I was in Denver and Arizona, Phoenix and then Tucson, the week before on an investigation. And Jaime had just arrived in Mexico as a temporary agent to assist in another investigation out of the Laredo office. And so I hadn't seen him, I hadn't met him. When I went in Monday morning to the office and I got the assignment in the afternoon, they said, you're going to take what they referred to him as the TDYer, meaning the TDY agent, the temporary assigned agent, which was Jaime. You're going to take him with you. That's for the first time I met him. And despite only have known him for a few hours, the time that I shared with him was incredible. I felt like I've known him all my life. He shared some very, very intimate details and personal details about himself and his life to a person that he had just met. So we really hit it off in that Suburban when we were driving. And he shared about his fiance and his plans. And let me tell you what I learned from him. I learned that he was a big fisherman. He's a big barbecue guy. And I knew genuinely that this was a good, hardworking agent. As a matter of fact, while we were driving, he received a call from one of the ports of entries in Laredo that they had seized one of his lookouts. And so that's what I knew. I said, this guy's a working agent. And he also reminded me a lot of me and his ambition to, you know, also being from the border, wanting to pursue his career in other directions. And I really admire that of him. Now that I look back, sometimes I can't believe the stuff that he shared with me, very personal details about him and his fiance, especially, and his plans for the future. And he sought my advice on how I did it, how I got there. I shared that with him. I even kidded around with him for him to brush up on his Spanish skills because he wasn't a very good Spanish speaker. And I said, you want to come out here? You better brush up on your Spanish skills and maybe get into an intense course because that'll change your career out here and how successful you are with communicating with the government of Mexico. But It was an incredible amount of time. The shorter period amount of time, it was really very rewarding, and everything that I got to learn from him.
Victor and Jaime were ordered an assignment to travel on Mexico's Highway 57, well known to agents and executives as a forbidden and dangerous corridor.
Highway 57 is the main corridor that we would travel numerous times. Highway 57 was not new to me. I had driven it many, many times, and that's the main highway, toll road, the nice road that connects you, Mexico City, all the way to Texas. It's about an 11-hour drive, more or less, if you take it all the way to the border in Texas. And at that time, it actually had started about 6 months before. We had already been receiving a lot of intelligence that the Zeta cartels were having a lot of firefights and confrontations with Mexican military and Mexican police on Highway 57. And they had already gained a lot of control of the San Luis Potosí area, which is a state that, you know, the highway runs through a lot of states, as you can imagine. That's one of the bigger ones that Highway 57 runs along the side of the state. And so there had been already two alerts, one 6 months prior, and the one that you referred to, Jay, is the one in January, I think it was 17 or 18, about 3 weeks before our shooting. The State Department, via the U.S. ambassador, issued an alert saying that all U.S. personnel were prohibited from driving on that highway, whether for personal reasons or business reasons. You couldn't go on that road. You couldn't drive on it. If you had to, for whatever reason, you needed written consent from the ambassador. And so nobody was driving on there. That's why this assignment was so, you know, in my supervisor's case, and ICE, and very negligent in sending us there, because they ignored that alert. But I challenged the assignment. When the assignment came, I talked to my supervisor about this. I talked to our ICE agents that were stationed at the Monterey consulate, who we were going to meet to exchange this equipment. And we all agreed, even especially the guys from Monterey, say, listen, Victor, this is, they refer to it as scrimmages on this highway, and it's too hot to go on there. And so, you know, logically, I said, why are we doing this? Why aren't we sending this equipment that they want to use for another investigation? Why are we not sending it through a diplomatic pouch, which is a protected, you know, source of transportation, a truck that brings U.S. Embassy correspondence, or we could fly it. There's other very, very common ways and easy ways to bring it into the country, but all those were shut down. And I even had my supervisor go to the deputy attaché, his boss, and ask him again why we were doing it this way. And he shut us down and said he wanted that equipment by the close of business day the following day. And at that point, we were ordered, and now we were just having to now make arrangements with our agents in Monterey to see where we were going to make the exchange.
On the fateful day, Victor and Jaime set out to transfer investigative equipment needed by fellow agents.
That day, February 15, was a beautiful day. Jaime showed up. Another agent took him to my apartment because I lived in north of the city. And it's just because of traffic, it was just better to just leave from there. So he got dropped off at my apartment at 6:30 in the morning. And we get in my issued armored Suburban, a 2009 Chevrolet Suburban. And, you know, it's equipped with emergency lights, a siren, a PA system, even a tracker that I'll talk about a little bit later. But we head off, and that's where the conversation that I had with Jaime, it was nonstop. It was very relaxing. I'm wearing jeans and a polo shirt, and so is he. And we head off and hit the highway right away. And our first stop was to refuel, because these Suburbans are big-time gas guzzlers. And we refuel, and we continue on until about 11:30 that morning is when we made the exchange. We met up, ironically, at kilometer marker 100. There's a little restaurant there. And we meet my coworker from the Monterey office and another gentleman that was with them. And they also drive the same Suburban that I drive, just a different color. We open the back and load up these boxes. And there was a lot of boxes and you know, big boxes, small boxes. It took lowering the second row seat also, in addition to the third row seat. But it was a beautiful, clear day. I referred to Jaime that this was one of the perks of being assigned in Mexico is the weather. I mean, it was San Diego weather. That's what I told him it was.
Victor and Jaime were in an armored vehicle equipped with reinforcements and other safety features, some of which were not properly maintained. They were unaware of a flaw in the vehicle's mechanics that caused the door locks to automatically open when placed in park.
Yes, very, very distinguished plates, diplomatic plates. They say MD, initials of MD, which is, in Spanish is Misión Diplomática, or like diplomatic mission. And it has a number. They're white. They're very different than any other plates. Very, very easily identifiable. And even the armored vehicle looks armored. It looks different than a regular Suburban. It was one of many oversights. We never thought of it tactically that was an oversight and a potential hazard. But that's the way they were programmed. Now they're not. But in addition to that, my siren wasn't working. The PA system wasn't working. Those vehicles are very expensive vehicles and require a lot of maintenance. And those vehicles in Mexico City did not make sense because of the traffic and the hilly type of terrain that has that in the city. I mean, we were going through breaks once a month. And the vehicles were not being maintained accordingly because they didn't have that portion set up like a contractor to have them maintained. Months back, they had installed a GPS tracker, which was for all intents and purposes, it was a great idea. It was a toggle switch that you hit up, and that toggle switch, as soon as you switch it either up or down, it would send an immediate signal into a room in Washington, D.C., and it's a distress signal, and it would allow them to know exactly where you were at. Well, it hadn't been working for months. You know, the little red light was flashing red instead of green for months, and even though we had all brought it up saying these things are not working, they had never fixed them. And I still, during the shooting, I hit the switch and didn't send the signal to D.C. until 8 hours later.
After making their delivery and taking a short break, Jaime and Victor continued southbound on Highway 57, heading home towards Mexico City, when they noticed vehicles trailing them and spotting a passenger in possession of a rifle.
Now we're heading back to Mexico City. I'm still driving up until about 1:30 p.m., where we stop at a Subway restaurant. This is a big rest area gas station that we're very familiar with. There's a Subway, there's a Church's Chicken, there's other restaurants in there, very clean. We always stop there as a break and a restroom break. And Jaime saw the Subway and he really wanted to eat there. And I said, yeah, absolutely, we'll eat at the Subway. It was a very peaceful day, very calm day, very little traffic and very not many people at the rest area that day. And we ate outside. We were there for about 30 minutes, and we're headed back to the Suburban. I threw Jaime the keys, and I tell him, okay, it's your turn to drive, so you could help me drive and also get familiar with the armored vehicle. He had never driven an armored vehicle before. There was no training established. Now there is, of course, but back then there wasn't. Just like for me, there never was any kind of training on how to maneuver or handle an armored vehicle. That Suburban weighed almost 6 tons, so it really does drive differently. And so he gets in the behind the wheel. I'm on my BlackBerry trying to get all this work done. As you can imagine, Mexico City at that time was the busiest ICE office in the world. And so I had conferences and arrests and I don't know what else stuff going on at the same time. So I really wanted to take advantage of just getting some of that work done. I called my supervisor, gave him our location, and tell him, listen, we're about 4.5 hours, maybe 5, just to get into the city. And Mexico City rush hours between 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. And I even told Jaime, listen, when we get to the city, I'll take over because it's just going to be a nightmare. I'll drive in the city. And I told my supervisor, we'll get in, but by the time we actually get it down, I'll drop off Jaime at whatever time we get through traffic. And so that's Jaime, it takes off and he's the one that starts driving at that time. Jaime is the one that brought it to my attention. I was kind of buried on my BlackBerry, and two SUVs within, Jaime had only been driving maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, and two SUVs passed us on our left side. It's a four-lane highway, two going north, two going south. We're on the far right lane, and on our left lane, two SUVs pass us. You know, we're going about 70, 72 miles an hour. These guys are going 90 plus miles an hour, and Jaime looks up and tells me, hey, there's a long gun in the second SUV in the back. And I look up and I catch the silhouette of a long gun sticking in the middle of the seat. And I see, you know, it's occupied by several individuals. And I kind of just said, Jaime, you know what, just let them go. Because they were going so fast that we could almost immediately barely see them. And I said, good, they're gone. Like, just let them be.
Jaime and Victor were forced from the road in a well-orchestrated vehicle assault roadblock.
But within seconds, we were up on them. They had completely reduced their speed down to about 20, 30 miles an hour. And so we come up on them, and they're basically blocking the road. And initially, there was one SUV in front, one right next to us. And they start kind of like trying to box us in. And I tell Jaime, go, 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 like punch it. And he does, and he tries to maneuver in between the two SUVs to pass them. But again, the SUV is not a performance vehicle. Their SUVs are a lot lighter, and they get back into this rolling roadblock position. And the second time they do it, the vehicle right next to us, which is right next to Jaime on his driver's side, they lower the windows with their long guns, AK-47s and other long guns, out of the two windows, driver's side and the back side, back window, back driver's side. I'm sorry, back passenger side, pointing at us, yelling to pull over. And I'm telling Jaime to nod, and Jaime's trying to avoid the collision because they're like mirror to mirror, like right next to each other. And Jaime's pulling our Suburban to the right. The vehicle at the same time in front of us is stopping dramatically, and Jaime's trying to avoid that collision. So they executed a rolling roadblock, eventually pushing us to the right shoulder.
Victor and Jaime were instantly forced into an armed confrontation with cartel members.
As soon as we get pulled over and pushed to the right side, we come to a complete stop, and they get out. About, I don't know, 8 to 10 of them get out and kind of do a semicircle in front of our Suburban with long guns and handguns. And one of the guys with a handgun comes over to Jaime's driver's side door and opens the door because Jaime had placed it in park, as we talked about it, and locked it. He opens the door and swings it wide open. But Jaime immediately, as soon as it's open, gets the handle and closes it right back. It wasn't open, not even a second. That 1 second that he opened, I see from my passenger side, him holding a handgun. And, you know, all the other guys are yelling at the same time, simultaneously, to get out, open the door. And Jaime shuts the door, and we start hitting that lock button. Well, when we were pressing all the buttons to lock the doors, we inadvertently lowered my armored window on my side a couple of inches. We didn't even know that had happened. We were still concentrating. The guy at the door was the one kind of that took the lead. He was like the leader of that squad. And he was yelling and telling Jaime to open the door. He's yanking at the door handle. And then out of no warning, he shoots a couple of rounds, like towards the door and towards the front tire. And I remember telling Jaime, did he just effing shoot? Like, it was kind of, Jay, we were kind of in a disbelief and a lot of confusion. Like, I can't believe this is actually happening. Like, it can't be. We're not the people that, if they want, it's not us. And that's what I started saying. Listen, if you're confusing us, we're not who you think we are. We're Americans. We're U.S. diplomats. This is a diplomatic vehicle. We work at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. I was yelling that at the top of my lungs. And they just completely ignored that and said, oh, get out, open the door. And during that whole commotion, I even told them, let me identify myself. Let me give you my diplomatic passport. This whole time, we have our hands up, almost pasted to the front windshield. And without notice, two guys then come around to my side. One introduces an AK-47 and the other one a handgun right here by my head. And as soon as they do that, I move back into the, kind of the side of the seatbelt area and push my shoulder against the Suburban, because remember, there's a bunch of boxes behind us. We can't jump to the back. It's full of boxes. And so I get the button and raise the window, and it catches the two barrels of the two guns, and it clinches them, and they start wiggling the AK-47. I could see the guy wiggling the AK-47 up and down, and the guy with a handgun trying to wiggle them. While they're doing that, without warning, they open fire. And they, when they open fire, the first thing that goes is my hearing. They're right next to my left ear, because I'm turning, kind of facing them, trying to make myself smaller. And I see Jaime get hit on his right torso with the handgun. I didn't see when the AK-47 hit his leg, but I could see it. Jaime yells out, I'm hit, I'm shot. And I tell him, go. They pull out their guns, and I still had my finger on the window. With my right hand, the window goes up. I had even before that wiggled. I grabbed the handgun with my left hand and burned my left hand, wiggling the handgun from the guy. And they eventually pulled them out, and the window goes up, and they just start spraying. You know, they say they recovered over 90 or close to 100 rounds. And they shoot up the right side of the Suburban, and I tell Jaime, go.
With Jaime wounded and unresponsive in the driver's seat, Victor attempted to retake control of the situation and escape.
I get the gear shift and slam it down. I put my hand on Jaime's knee, his right leg, and push it on the accelerator, the gas. And it does, to try to escape. It hits and crash. We crash the front Suburban that's blocking us. And it does that, and I'm trying to maneuver the steering wheel, but the Suburban kind of just crosses the highway into the median. It's a big kind of open median, and I get the steering wheel to try to steer the Suburban back on Highway 57, and that's where it stops. That's where it ended up. You can see pictures of that on the internet.
Their temporary calm was interrupted when the Sicarios returned to finish off their assassination.
I start tending to Jaime, I'm yelling at him. I'm trying to keep him awake. I'm telling him that help is on its way, that they're going to come get us. And during that whole commotion, I'm trying to attend to his wound in his leg now. This whole time I had already been shot, but I didn't even know that I had been shot. I didn't notice or felt anything. One of the Suburbans, one of them leaves. I didn't see that one leave, but another Suburban, for one of their SUVs, it looks like it's leaving, and then it does a U-turn, comes back, and they park right in front of our Suburban, like hood to hood. Two of them get out with AK-47. They look at me, I look at them, and they just open fire on the front windshield, and I kind of just froze there for a second. They jump back on their SUVs and leave.
Now stranded, alone, injured and dying, Victor desperately worked to tend to Jaime's wounds and call for backup.
I get on my phone, my Nextel radio back then, it doesn't work. I get on the BlackBerry and I call the U.S. Embassy. And I'm telling the guy, ICE agent Victor Avila, we are shot on Highway 57 and where we're at. And I referred to the Highway 57 as the Querétaro, Mexico, because that's what we referred to it back then, highway. And eventually a lot of people get on the phone. The call gets transferred over to the regional security office, the diplomatic security special agents that answer the phone there at the embassy. My wife happens to be 5 feet away because she was working there as a background investigator. So the receptionist gets the call and yells out, Victor Avila has been shot. My wife comes out of the office, what did you just say?
I walk towards the front desk, and she's on the phone and she's screaming, Agent Avila has been shot. Agent Avila has been shot. I lost it. I can't remember what I did, but I know that I was escorted. I started yelling, just give me the phone, let me talk to him. I kept asking, is Victor okay? Is Victor okay? Can somebody please tell me how my husband is?
And it's important to say earlier that day when my wife showed up to work that morning, you know, they asked her, hey, how's Victor doing? And she told them, oh, Victor, he's going to Monterey and the Highway 57. And everybody there at the regional security office, what are you talking about? No one's supposed to be on that highway. And, you know, that's what it is. But it was even more confusion because no one knew. No one knew that we were on there other than my supervisors and us. And so eventually a lot of people get on the phone. I then call our head of our vetted unit of the federal Mexican police. And he is able to dispatch a helicopter to our area. I was able to give them the GPS coordinates because I didn't know exactly where I was at. I knew we were on the highway. I just didn't know what kilometer marker or what town. And so eventually I gave them the GPS coordinates. I asked the federal police to please send someone that I can trust, that I can verify their credentials, because at that point I didn't trust anyone.
The first sign of help was not what it appeared to be.
One guy shows up that appears to be an ambulance. You know, it's the what we all recognize what an ambulance looks like. And he parks across the highway and comes over and, you know, demanding for me to open the door. And I refuse. I refuse to open the door. And he just doesn't really put up a fight and leaves. Well, I find out years later at the trial, back in this just a couple of years ago in 2017, that guy was the Zeta cartel ambulance. They have their own ambulance and their own rescue when they get involved in shootouts.
A long 40 minutes passed before real support arrived.
It was an eternity, and it wasn't until one of my ICE coworkers who was a paramedic before he became a special agent, he's the first one to alert me. He told me, check yourself, Victor, check yourself. And like physically take your hands and check yourself. And that's the first time I realized that I looked down at my left leg and I had been shot in my left leg and my pants are, you know, just dripping with blood. And then I noticed my chest. I've been shot on the right side of my chest. And he says, take off your belt and cinch it as high as you can, as high as you can on your leg. I did do that. So it was very dramatic. The third shot in my lower leg, I didn't know until I got to the hospital that I had been shot in the lower leg. But it was absolutely eternal time. The 40 minutes was, my goodness. You know, a lot of shootings happen, you know, within 5 seconds, 12 seconds. This was the shootings were, you describe it accurately. It's kind of two-parter here. And it wasn't one of those quick shootings. It was that one initial and then the other one.
Himself shot multiple times, his partner dying before his eyes and stranded in the heart of cartel-controlled territory, Victor sensed absolute isolation.
And then the waiting afterwards was just, all it did was make me aware of where I was now. And it made me feel so foreign being in Mexico, being a Mexican-American. I love Mexico. I felt like such a person that really didn't belong there. And also I feared, that's when the fear for my life really came in, because I thought for sure these guys are going to come and take care of me either there or at the hospital. I that was for certain. I was petrified to go to the hospital because I knew that, you know, I've worked cases like this before in the border where the cartel go back to the hospital and funerals and kill the guys that survived. So I was at my utmost fear at that point. I was just dreading going to the hospital.
Although critically wounded himself, Victor refused to give up on the life of Jaime.
When they all showed up and they were taking me out of the Suburban, and I told the Mexican federal police, we're not leaving without him. We're not leaving without him. And then one of the police officers yells out, well, your partner's dead. And I said, you don't know that. You don't know what he's coming in with me, and you're putting him on this helicopter, and we're going to the hospital together. And then they thought they had detected a possible pulse. They don't know that. I don't know that for sure. But I do know is that they brought him with me in the helicopter, and we left together.
Even while receiving medical attention, Victor was unwilling to drop his guard.
When we showed up to the hospital, it was they thought we were Mexican federal police. They don't know that we were Americans. And I didn't tell them who I was on purpose. I didn't want to identify myself. I was so scared that I didn't trust anyone, even at the hospital. I don't know if the doctors or staff are bought off by these cartels. And so it was kind of a very unique situation during that time. And they kind of like just left me. They did great work on me. They went through the trauma. They did really, really good work and great medical care, that I have to say. And then minutes later, I would say within 30 to an hour, 30 minutes to an hour of being there, one of the lead doctors came in and said, your partner has passed away. And I told him, please treat him with dignity and respect. And then the whole cavalry then from Mexico City showed up, and Black Hawk landed right next door, not even the helipad. And then these heavy armed guys came into the room and said, you're Victor Avila? I said, yes. He says, we're here on direct orders from the commander in Mexico City, my friend that I talked to. You are secure now. The building is secure. And that's the first time I kind of breathed a sigh of relief. And that's when I identified myself. I'm Victor Avila. I'm a special agent with ICE. I'm an American.
The bullet wounds took their toll. Victor speaks openly about the second set of injuries he suffered from the shooting.
Yes, I do have PTSD. Yes, I went through depression and anxiety. And I suffer, I just had an injection on my back just this past Friday. I still get treatment for that. I have a lot of issues with my hip area, and I'm very functional. I'm happy to be, but I do continue to go through these treatments. I still, to this day, go to counseling. And so the wellness is also a very, very important, because I did go through that. And I like to talk about it, Jay, because it is something that even now that PTSD is more, has been made of, more aware of, and people have learned more about it, it's still something that a lot of police officers and agents are in military, they shy about wanting to get some kind of treatment for it. And there's nothing to be ashamed of when it comes to your mental health. You know, we've all been trained as a law enforcement officer to work out and lift weights and run, and you have to be in this good physical condition to do this job. Well, it is as important to continue to maintain the good mental health as well. And I can't emphasize that so well. And the reason I'm right here talking to you today is because I was able to get that treatment. I had the support from my family.
Victor talks about the emotional trauma he experienced and the effect that it had on those closest to him.
And my wife, I owe her all that support because they stood by me. I wasn't a very good person to be around with after the shooting. I struggled through a lot. And that could be another phone call and another interview, but it really was something that I think sometimes was worse than the actual shooting.
The weapons used by the cartel members to assault Victor and Jaime were traced back to a corrupt gun-running operation orchestrated by ATF.
I learned about the weapons. Agent Brian, Border Patrol Agent Brian Terry, was killed December of 2010, 2 months before us in Arizona, with Fast and Furious guns. These are guns that were being walked and allowed to go south to Mexico under the watch of the government and ATF. And we learned that two of the guns that were recovered from our shooting were from a very similar operation, almost identical, but just out of Texas. And this is not speculation, this is a fact, and we have the ballistics report and all that. But we've struggled with the government trying to get our records. We file a Freedom of Information Act request, and they get denied, or we get redacted pieces of paper. And it's been an ongoing battle to get records, not just for my shooting, but also on the Fast and Furious part of it, because there's a lot of other people involved, gun shop owners and the such, that we really want answers, the Terry family as well. And so that's something that I'm gonna continue to fight for. It's hard to fight them. I'm exploring all options. Judicial Watch, Office of Special Counsel has been very good. I'm pursuing them to get some answers. But yeah, we're trying to get. It's very hard to get through the what President Obama did is a protective order, whatever they call it, of a protection to not allow any of these documents to be released. And so, you know, we're trying to get that lifted so we could get access to it. And we're, you know, eight and a half years later, we're still fighting for that.
Victor medically retired in 2015. Discouraging is the treatment he received from his agency, but empowering is his still positive attitude and desire to keep the memory of Jaime Zapata alive.
There's another story there behind that we haven't shared as to the treatment that I got from my own agency, which is a complete failure. They didn't know what to do with me. They had this agent that survived this horrific shooting, and you know, they didn't want me back. At one point, I didn't want to go back anymore. It was a very, very difficult situation with my agency. I never asked for anything or any special treatment from anyone other than just kind of take care of me and my family and put me somewhere where I can continue working, but that didn't work. And I took the medical retirement in 2015, but I got to move on. I got to pay the bills. You know, it's been a struggle that way. I wasn't being picky as to what, but that's not the case. They did not want me there. They did not want me talking about it. One of the suggestions was, let me go to the academy and teach at the academy and kind of, you know, at least if I don't live there, send me to the academy once in a while to teach a class and maybe the graduating class as to what happened. But that doesn't happen. As a matter of fact, our agency hardly ever does anything on February 15th. You know, I compare it to what DEA does on the anniversary of DEA agent Enrique Camarena, Key Camarena, that was killed in Mexico in 1985. They do a tribute every year to him, and it's very public. It's on the website, and his memory is never forgotten. But for me, February 15 comes and goes without anything, and that's just a shame. My agency doesn't acknowledge it. I've ran into new agents, new ICE, HSI special agents now, they don't even know that the shooting happened. I was in New York a couple of weeks ago and being honored by the NYPD. And I tell my wife, I've been honored by a lot of people. And it's such a great feeling to have that and to keep Jaime's memory alive with those type of awards. But they come from other agencies. They don't come from our own agency.
Victor's survival was nothing short of a miracle and likely an indication that God was not yet done with what Victor still has to offer as he seeks a greater purpose in life.
Faith has played a role in my life, my entire life. I grew up as a Catholic, as a practicing Catholic. I have a lot of faith in God. I believe in God. I pray. And I hands down believe that day God chose not to take me, and that's the only reason I'm here talking to you today. It was his choice to leave me here for other reasons that I'm still exploring. Maybe the only reason is just to be with my wife and kids. Maybe as simple as that. Or maybe it's beyond that. Maybe it's something else that as a survivor, he kept me here. Because the shooting itself, if you look at it just in physical scientific terms, it was almost impossible to survive that. And so my faith is the reason why I'm here, my belief in God. And that's really what's also kept me from, you know, I'm not a drug user. I'm not an alcoholic. Having all these issues with the PTSD and all that, I'm very fortunate to have that faith base in my life because it's kept me going and put me to where I'm at in a much better place today. And I'm looking forward to those, you know, those better days. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, you know, I do a little bit of the public speaking. I started doing this presentation. It helps me a lot. It really, I get to tell people about the story and what happened, and also include within that story what's happening in Mexico, the cartel violence, and all this immigration issues that we have, border security. I have that knowledge. I want to give that knowledge back. Most of my life, I've been a public servant, and that's what I like to do. I want to give this information that I have and this knowledge that I have, I want to be able to give back. And I don't know, I like politics, and that might be my calling. I don't know, I really want to be able to give a difference and share this in a way where I can make a difference in maybe legislation or other policy type of making positions.
Victor gives credit for his recovery to his wife and kids.
She has been, and my kids, they have been, if there is a definition and a picture of resiliency, it's them. My kids went to 9 different schools in a 3-year span, and moving around and all that. And their support system, their non-judgmental approach to my getting better and treatment is just unbelievable. My wife and the strong woman that she is, I give her all the credit. I tell you, I might not have been a good guy to hang around even before the shooting, I'm a little bit of a stubborn guy. And so for her to hang around afterwards, I give her that credit. I give my siblings credit, my parents. They were really very, very supportive of what happened. You know, I lost a lot of my identity after the shooting, because when you're in law enforcement, Jay, that people know you as such. This is you're the father, the husband, the son, but everybody deep down knows you're the guy that carries a gun and has a badge, and that's what you do. Well, when I got that taken away from me, it was very difficult for me to go through that and that identity process. And so my family was there to back that up. And knowing that I was more than just that, that was just something that I happened to do for a living, but it didn't completely define me, even though I thought it did. I'm more than just being a special agent, and I can offer a lot more things for the rest of my life.
Victor is convinced that he has much more to offer and that his best is still yet to come.
Raising my 2 great kids, I've been very, very blessed with my children. I have a daughter in college and a freshman in high school. And that's been my greatest accomplishment, to have been able to go through this and still do a decent job with them so far has been a great accomplishment for me. Regrets, a lot of people ask me, do you regret going to Mexico? Of course I regret the shooting, but I don't regret the assignment in Mexico. I volunteered for that assignment. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to grow as an investigator. I wanted to do that. And so I don't have many, many big regrets in my life.
Victor closes with advice for all of us to not neglect our self-care. He moves onward with his hard-earned formula to lead a good life.
I like people to listen to themselves. And I'm not talking about selfishness here. I think it's important to, once in a while, we're so preoccupied with what everybody else thinks in life, and we're hooked on our phones, that it's important to sit down and kind of look introspectively and listen to oneself once in a while and pay attention to yourself. And I'm talking about not just your physical well-being, but like I mentioned before, your mental wellness and mental health wellness. No matter what you do, you might be super stressed out at the bank. You might be super stressed out because you're a teacher, and whatever profession that you do, it is important to grasp that and be able to manage that, because as you can go out and run a mile and lift, do push-ups and do a lot for your physical, there's other things you can do for your mental wellness as well. And I always tell people to listen to their gut and their instinct, because that's going to really tell them what kind of decision I think they're going to make. And like we know in life, it's very hard to make the right decision versus very easy to make the wrong one. So take time and make the right decision, even though it's going to be the hard one. Make that right decision, and that's because you paid attention to yourself. You've listened to your gut instinct, and I give that advice to people that at least will help them make those small or big decisions in their life.
Victor has prepared a book on his amazing experiences. He's anxious to speak with anyone in the publishing world who shares his interest in helping the story be told. Victor provides keynote speaking to law enforcement and corporate groups, as well as case study training that elevates the knowledge, tactics, and safety of those in law enforcement. He serves as an expert consultant on narcotic smuggling, human trafficking, cartel violence, immigration, and other border issues. Victor can be found on Twitter at VicSurvivor11. Copland is produced for those courageous men and women whose alarm clock goes off every day. They put their feet on the ground, buckle on gear, and kiss their families goodbye with no guarantee they will ever come home. They go willingly, facing predators and violence on behalf of good and innocent people who simply want to live safe, peaceful lives. Thank you for listening. God bless and go be amazing.